Now, David still had to get away from Saul. And so in chapter 20, we read how he fled and came to Jonathan, his friend. That was the only one he could think of. He had tried Samuel the prophet, and now he had to get away and go back to his friend Jonathan, because Saul had come to fetch him where he was with Samuel. Chapter 20, read verses 1 through 4. Then David fled from Naioth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father, that he seeks my life?" So Jonathan said to him, "By no means. You shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It isn't so." Then David took an oath again and said, "Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he says, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." So Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you." When David came to Jonathan, he dropped a bombshell into Jonathan's lap. Jonathan had no idea that his father was after David again. He thought, after he had convinced his father and his father had sworn, "As the Lord lives, not a hair of David's head shall perish," Jonathan thought that was it. But he didn't know his father. And he didn't know that his father had secretly, without telling him, sought to kill David. And now David was here in a panic before Jonathan. And Jonathan couldn't believe his eyes, he couldn't believe his ears. So he said to David, "Okay, well, if this is the case, what can I do about it?" And David said to Jonathan, verse 5, "Indeed, tomorrow is the new moon." That's what we call Rosh Chodesh. "And I shall not fail to sit with the king to eat. But let me go, that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family.' If he says thus, 'It is well,' your servant will be safe. But if he is very angry, then be sure that evil is determined by him." So that was David's deal with Jonathan. "I'm going back to my family. We have a yearly sacrifice. Let me go, and you tell your father that I got your permission to go. And then see what his reaction is. If he takes it all right, then obviously it doesn't bother him. But if he's very angry, it's because he was hoping I would be there and he could lay hands on me." And so David ended by saying in verse 8, "Therefore you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there is iniquity in me, kill me yourself. For why should you bring me to your father? If I am really guilty, go ahead and execute me. I'm willing to die if I'm a sinner." And Jonathan, of course, said, "Far be it from you. No, I would never lay hands on you. And I don't believe for a moment that you are guilty." So they went out into the field and they made a pact together. Verse 12. Then Jonathan said to David, "The Lord God of Israel is witness. When I have sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. I promise faithfully that I will let you know what has happened." And so, verse 16, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies. May God punish all those that seek to hurt David. He also made a request. It may appear strange to us, but he says in verse 15, "You shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever, no, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." What he meant was this. When there were two rivals to the throne, when one succeeded, he eliminated the opposition. We've seen how in the last week one party was swept from power and the other party was swept in by the votes of the country. Well, we would think it barbarous in the extreme if now the victorious party went ahead and murdered all those that have been defeated in the election. We don't do such things. It is not done. And the reason why it isn't done is because this Bible has had its effect on this country. But in those days, the civilizations around, and even the people of Israel, when they weren't walking with God, thought it was a normal thing. If a rival got to the throne, he murdered everybody else that stood in his way or that could challenge his right to the throne. So Jonathan says to David, when you come to the throne, please do not eliminate my family. It hardly needed to be asked, but Jonathan did ask it of David, and we find afterwards that David respected it to the full. You shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. Saul was like that. Saul was so jealous and he held on to his throne so tightly that if anyone threatened, he went after them and he sought to kill them. That's why he was after David, because he knew that God had chosen David to be king after him. Verse 16, so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David. Then they decided on some sort of sign they should give. Verse 18, then Jonathan said to David, "Tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty. And when you have stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed, and remain by the stone Ezel. Then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side of it, as though I shot at a target, and there I will send a lad, saying, 'Go find the arrows.' If I expressly say to him, 'Look, the arrows are on this side of you, get them and come,' then as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm. But if I say thus to the young man, 'Look, the arrows are beyond you,' go your way, for the Lord has sent you away." So David did that. He went and hid. He went first to Bethlehem, to his family, to celebrate. Then he came back on the third day and he hid. And then we read what happened with Saul. Verse 25. Now the king sat on his seat as at other times, on a seat by the wall. And Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, something has happened to him. He is unclean. Surely, he is unclean. Uncleanness was very temporary. It was a ceremonial thing. If someone was unclean, they had to bathe themselves in water from head to foot, and they were unclean until sunset. And after that, they were clean, they could come back into the camp, and they could mix with other people. So Saul thought, oh, maybe something has happened to him, something by chance, some sort of uncleanness. But on the second night, verse 27, and it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan his son, "Why has the son of Jesse not come to eat either yesterday or today?" That was an expression of contempt. Son of Jesse, David was the son-in-law to Saul. Saul had given him his daughter Michal for wife. Why did he have to say, son of Jesse? It was an expression of contempt. He doesn't belong to me. He's the son of Jesse. I have nothing to do with him. That's really what he was implying. So Jonathan answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he repeated what David had asked him. Then verse 30, then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan. They said to him, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman. That's really swearing at his son. And what he was saying is, your mother is a perverse, rebellious woman, and you just take after her. He's really abusing his son. Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? Now, why did he say that? The shame of your mother's nakedness. That reveals another cultural practice. When someone succeeded to the throne, he inherited the wives of the previous king. And what Saul was saying to Jonathan is, you have chosen the son of Jesse, he's going to take your mother, she's going to become his wife legally and culturally, and so it's going to be to the shame of your mother's nakedness. For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established nor your kingdom. Now therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die. Saul was in a rage, abusing his son, insulting his own wife, calling her names, calling her down. Of course Jonathan asked the obvious question. Verse 32, and Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, why should he be killed? What has he done? There's another man that asked a similar question. His name was Nicodemus. When the Sanhedrin had decided that Yeshua had to die because he was causing too much trouble and there's likely to be trouble with the Romans, it was better for Yeshua to die and that would bail them out from trouble with the Romans. Nicodemus said, does our Lord judge any man before it hears him and knows what he does? And that is indeed the case. Why should he be killed? What has he done? Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. Jonathan was angry not only because he had been insulted, but because David had been insulted as well. And in the morning, verse 35, Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. Then he said to his lad, now run, find the arrows which I shoot. And of course, he shot the arrows beyond the stone. Verse 37, when the lad had come to the place where the arrows was which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. Jonathan gave him the bow and the arrows. He said, here, you take them back to the city. To me, there's a human touch here. Here's this little boy carrying the weapons of one of the most famous warriors of Israel, the bow and arrows of the royal prince, Jonathan, that great hero of Israel. Can you imagine how he walked, how he swaggered, how his friends gathered around him? Where did you get Jonathan's bow and arrows from? Oh, he told me to pick up his arrows for him. Can you imagine this little boy strutting all the way into the city? If he was a normal little boy, I guess he made the most of it. Verse 40, then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go, carry them to the city. With the little boy safely out of the way, not knowing the coded message, David appeared, fell on his face, bowed 3 times, and then they hugged, they kissed each other, they wept. David more so, which shows that David's love for Jonathan was even greater than that of Jonathan for David. Or perhaps it was because Jonathan was going back to his home, he's going back to God's house. But David knew that he was now going to be an exile from both. Crisis. What do we do when we are in crisis? I'll tell you what David did. He sought out a faithful friend. He did seek his God, but he also sought out the one he could trust in, who could share his heartache, who could share his burden. And you will find that there's never a time in your life that God hasn't got someone to cry with you, someone to share your load, someone to pray with you and for you. Never. Yeshua was forsaken on the cross at Golgotha. My God, he cried, why hast thou forsaken me? In order that you and I should never, as believers, know the same thing. He said, I will never leave you, I will never forsake you. So David went his way and Jonathan returned into the city. What could David do now? He was out in the cold. Well, he decided he needed some help and off he went to the priest. Chapter 21, we come to David's flight. Now David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? And this is when David told a lie. So David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I have commanded you. And I have directed my young men to such and such a place. Before we're too hard on David, what would we have done? Or can you suggest what he should have done? He was in a tight spot. And this is one of the cases where you and I have to be very careful not to be too hard or too down on David. What could he have done? Suppose he had said to Ahimelech, I'm running away from Saul, can you rescue me? What do you think Ahimelech would have done? I don't think Ahimelech would have helped him. Ahimelech would have probably backed off and said, I can't help you. In our troubles, we'll find very few are willing to stick their necks out. And so David resorted to a lie. I still wonder, what could David have done? What could he have said? Then he went on to speak to Ahimelech and asked him if he got any bread. And Ahimelech said, yes, I've got the showbread. The showbread was 12 loaves of unleavened bread. You see pictures of the showbread. You find the golden table of showbread and on it are 12 cottage loaves. Well, in those days, there were no cottage loaves. It's a Western concept, taken back. It's an anachronism, which means something out of due time in our thinking. We've imported our present-day thinking into the past. The showbread was made of 12 loaves of unleavened bread. They were very much like pita, pocket bread, piled up in 2 piles of 6. And every Shabbat, they would bake new 12 loaves and replace the old. They could eat the old because unleavened bread doesn't go stale the way leavened bread does. And it keeps for much longer. You know how it is with matzos. You can have a box of matzos from last Pesach. The next Pesach you can open it. All you have to do is to put it in the oven for a couple of minutes to crisp it, and it's fresh. That's the kind of bread that David asked for. Verse 4, and the priest answered David and said, there is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread, if the young men have at least kept themselves from women. I can't afford to have this bread desecrated. You can have it, but the young men, have they been moral? Have they been pure? Have they kept themselves from intercourse with women? And he probably doesn't mean their wives, because that was holy at all times. He's talking about the young men playing fast and loose with other women. And then David answered the priest and said to him, truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out. And the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was sanctified in the vessel this day. So he gave him the showbread. He gave him several loaves. But there was a catch. Verse 7. Now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. He would be detained before the Lord because there was some religious obligation he had to fulfill before he could proceed. And it just happened that way. And his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. David also asked for weapons. And Ahimelech the priest said, well, I've only got the sword of Goliath, the Philistine, that you slew. I've got it here, it's wrapped up in a cloth. If you want it, you can have it. I don't need it. So David took it. Verse 9, David said, there is none like it. Give it to me. I heard an application of that. The Bible is God's sword. And we should say of the word of God what David said of the sword of Goliath. There is none like that. Give it to me. David had more problems yet. Verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. Fancy going to the Philistines. He'd been fighting with them not so long ago. He had wrought great victories for the people of Israel. And yet the irony, the supreme irony was he expected more mercy from the idolatrous heathens than he could expect from Saul, his fellow Israelite. Can I apply that? Many times, unbelievers are more Christian in their behavior than many Christians. Isn't it a shame that sometimes the world shows believers up? That their code of honor is sometimes greater than ours? That we can learn from the heathen? It's a shame. It's a disgrace. We should be an example to the unbelievers. And instead, they are examples to us. It's ironic. Well, it happened with David. He could not expect mercy from his fellow Israelites. He knew he could expect mercy from the Philistines whom he had engaged in battle. How could that be? Well, one reason could be that because the Philistines may have thought, good, he's seeking for asylum from Saul, then we can use him against Saul. Maybe we can make him an enemy to Saul. In the time when there was the Iron Curtain. Remember how some people fled, some officers or some diplomats would seek asylum in the West. You'd think that coming to the West and seeking asylum, that the West would put them in prison, but the West used them. The people in the West used their knowledge, their experience, their expertise against Russia, and against the countries of the Iron Curtain, and vice versa as well. So David went to asylum, but let's not take away the honor of the Philistines here. The Philistines were honorable soldiers. And even though they had this man in their grasp, because he was at their mercy, they were not merciless towards him. But Achish, the king of Gath, had to reckon with his courtesans or his noblemen. Verse 11. And the servants of Achish said to him, "Is this not David the king of the land?" Fancy them saying that. Saul was the king of the land. But as far as they were concerned, David was the rightful king. And they were giving David the title which the men of Israel had not yet come to bestow on him. They were more realistic, weren't they? They were more on the ball. But they said, Is this not David the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances? They knew all about it. Those songs that the women sang as they greeted David coming back from the slaughter of Goliath and the Philistines. Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Now David took these words to heart and was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, feigned madness in their hands. That means he pretended to be a little bit cuckoo. Scratched on the doors of the gate and let his saliva fall down on his beard. So he just didn't go crazy, but he just behaved little gaga. Then Achish said to his servants, "Look, you see the man is insane. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen?" In other words, I've got plenty. I don't need any more. It's one of the touches of irony and humor that you have in the scripture. Have I need of madmen that you've brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? So he chased him off. And that's where you get Psalm 34. Psalm 34 was written when David was expelled. Let me read to you just a few verses from Psalm 34. Psalm 34 wasn't written by David in a moment of tranquility when he was sitting in his back garden under his vine and his fig tree. It was written when he had fled from the Philistines. Psalm 34, a psalm of David when he pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away, and he departed. "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together." Isn't that remarkable? We sang that this morning. "I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and delivered me from all my fears." He must have prayed desperately. So we find Abimelech was another name for the king of Gath. Abimelech or Achish. Many times men and women had two or even three names. We have two Abimelechs then in chapter 21. Abimelech the priest, Abimelech the king of Gath. From both of them, he obtained help from one, he sought help of the other, but had to run away. Alas, David had to flee to Gath for refuge because other surrounding nations were at peace with Saul and might have extradited him to Saul. Why did the king of Gath not put David to death. He is mad, kill him. And the answer is that even today, mad people are regarded with superstition by the people in the Middle East. They are a little superstitious about them. They hold them in awe. They stand back. Don't touch them. Don't harm them. Because the evil spirit that is in them might harm us. That's the attitude. So the best thing is get them out of the way as soon as you can. So they left David alone for that reason. But whenever we tell a lie, the consequences catch up with us. And in this case, it was terrible. David never imagined when he told that lie, you could, what the world would call a white lie. He never thought of the consequences. But we see from chapter 22 how terrible a lie can be. Even when it seems as though no harm is done, sometimes the consequences are devastating. Let's go on to chapter 22. David escapes to Adullam. David therefore departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's house heard it, they went down there to him. The reason why they did that is because they knew that if Saul was after David and he couldn't get hold of David, he would wreak his vengeance on David's family. And they knew that they were up for the chopping block unless they got out of the way. And everyone who was in distress, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him. So he became captain over them, and there were about 400 men with him. Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and mother come here with you till I know what God will do for me." So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. The Moabites and the Israelites were not particularly friends. They were usually scrapping with each other. But again, you see this code of honor that you find in that part of the world. When someone places themselves at the mercy of someone else, when someone comes into an enemy's house and eats with them, the enemy can't lay a finger on them. And what David did to the king of Moab was to ask him for his mercy. And the king of Moab was honor bound to do something. But then there was a link, wasn't there, between David and the Moabites? Who was David's great grandmother? Ruth. And she came from Moab. So David had some Moabite linkage. You can't say David had Moabite blood in his veins, because we know that the blood comes from the father. It doesn't come from the mother. That's why you get blue babies sometimes, when the blood of the mother conflicts with the blood of the baby. Anyway, the king of Moab looked after David's family. Verse 6, when Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Verse 7, then Saul said to his servants who stood about him, "Hear now, you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you all captains of thousands and captains of hundreds?" In other words, you've never had it so good. You never had it as good as this. If David is your king, he was appealing to the crass materialistic urge of the people. It happened in England too. There was a certain man who was leader of the Conservative Party, and his slogan in the election campaign was, "You've never had it so good." What a base motive he was appealing to the people in Britain. That's not the reason why we choose certain people to rule. The reason why we choose people is because they're men of principle, because they will do what is right, because they will honor the standards in God's word. Those are the things that should guide us in our choice of leaders. Well, he says, verse 8, all of you have conspired against me, and there's no one who reveals to me that my son has made a covenant with the son of Jesse. He doesn't mention David's name. And there's not one of you who is sorry for me or reveals to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. It was all fabrication. David was not lying in wait against Saul. He's trying to get away from him. Then came Doeg the Edomite. I saw David speaking with Ahimelech the priest. Ahimelech the priest inquired of God for him. He gave him food. He gave him a sword. In other words, Ahimelech is in on the plot. Verse 11, then the king sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, the priests who were in Nob, and they all came to the king. The long and the short of it was, the king condemned them all to death on the charge of treason, high treason against the king. Ahimelech protested in vain. Verse 14, and who among all your servants is so faithful as David, who is the king's son-in-law? How can you say that David is against you? He's your son-in-law. But the king wouldn't listen. He was mad with jealousy, with rage, very much like Herod the king after him, who murdered his own family when he suspected them of treason. And when he turned round to his soldiers and said, kill the priests, they wouldn't do it. The servants of the king would not lift up their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. Verse 18, and the king said to Doeg, you turn and kill the priests. So he did. This Edomite turned and struck the priests. Not only that, he went to their town and devastated the town and wiped out all the inhabitants, animal as well as human, with the edge of the sword. Cruel, vicious man. And we have another psalm that is written, which David wrote about that very thing, the murder of these people. I think it's Psalm 57 or 59, one of those psalms. But one of the sons escaped. Verse 20. Now one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. And when he told David what he had done, David realized that little lie was no small lie. But again, we come back to this whole dilemma. What could David have done? He was desperate. Verse 22, so David said to Abiathar, I knew that day when Doeg the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, I have caused the death of all the persons of your father's house. My little lie has ended in the death of 85 men, their wives, their children, their livestock. Can we say then that lie, there's such a thing as a white lie? Or that lies out. There are some that are more innocent than others. Not on this showing. How important it is. May I suggest what David could have done? We're going to have some feedback. But may I suggest what David could have done? He could have said, I'm on an emergency journey. And I left without taking food. And then left it to the Lord to guide Ahimelech as to what he should do. He certainly was on an emergency journey. He was running away from Saul. And I do believe this, that If Ahimelech had backed off and feared to help David, God would have raised up help for David from somewhere else. So when you and I are tempted to pull ourselves out of a hole by telling a lie, let's first pray about it. Let's ask God, what should I do? Suppose this last resort fails me. What am I to do then? And you'll find that when you throw yourself on God and you choose to trust Him, that God will come to your rescue. Well, I don't want to be too hard on David, because I'm sure that we've been in that predicament more than once. And when we look back, we have to say to ourselves, I don't see how I could have got myself out of that hole if I hadn't told that lie. But here's a stark warning of what can happen when we do it.